Stunned silence.
What is this?
A bit of an episode.
So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its game or something.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Sure.
You're tuned to 15 Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 134 for January 2019. And I'm your host, James, and in the Virtual Rendition Studios tonight we have Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Thanks, James. Happy New Year and
Happy
all that.
Happy New Year and all that to you too. And we also have the always lovely Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thanks, James. Good to be back for another year and kicking on with what 2019 has to offer.
Well, it's brilliant to have you back. And speaking of having back, we welcome back the Don. How are you, Don?
Good, bro. What's up?
Back from his journeys and travels and all the rest of it. And here he is back here on our humble Station 15 podcast. It's great to welcome you back, Don. For those who are new listeners to the podcast, you have to go back a few episodes to listen to Don. He is the original Don. None of this president rubbish. This is the original guy right here. You're going to get the truth. Some truth bombs. Fantastic. How is everyone doing? Happy New Year 2019. How's it all going?
Yeah, pretty good. I was wondering if you were going to get it right in the year, so I was impressed.
Well, it's almost like we've been doing this for more than 5 minutes, Gavin.
Yeah, no, but it's so easy. I've only done it once, I think. Oh, no, a couple of times, actually. I've referred to last year when I said last year when I meant like 2 years ago, really. So, but I haven't written it. When you don't write checks anymore, you're not as likely to write the wrong year, I've found. I don't know about you, check writers.
Yeah, interesting connection. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I definitely don't write checks very often. And the last time I had to write a check, I had to go and actually like Google it. Because I was like, yeah. I had to write one for, I think it was for the house or something to do with the house. And I remember like going, you have to cross it somewhere and you have to something about
not negotiable or something.
Yes, something like that. So I don't know, it's all a little bit hard. It challenged my dignity. But speaking of which, in our first story here from the Catholic News Service, securing borders and humane treatment of those fleeing persecution and seeking a better life are not mutually exclusive, the chairman of the U.S. Bishops Committee on Migration said. I should explain that segue. The heading was U.S. Bishops Call for Security and Human Dignity. And then I made the connection. All right, moving on. It's a bit rough. It's beginning of the year. It's still summer. It's hot. Give me a break. Here we go. The United States can ensure both and must do so without instilling fear or sowing hatred. Bishop Joe Vasquez of Austin, Texas, said in a statement. He called on President Donald Trump and leaders of Congress to come up with a solution that addresses the border, ends the partial government shutdown, and at the same time protects the sanctity of human life by recognizing the dignity of all people, regardless of their immigration status, and those federal employees suffering a loss of pay because of the shutdown, now well into its third week. We will continue to advocate for immigration reform to advance the common good and address these issues, Vasquez said. He urged Trump and congressional lawmakers, led by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, to come together and look beyond rhetoric to come up with a solution. In his statement, Vasquez highlighted that Pope Francis often says about migrants that they are not statistics, but persons with feelings that need ongoing protection. From our work serving immigrant and refugees along the U.S.-Mexico border, in the interior of the United States and throughout the world, we know this to be true, he said. We urge lawmakers to look beyond rhetoric and remember the human dignity that God our Father has given each and every one of us simply because we are all his children. Well, the good bishop weighing in on some of the politics there in the U.S. Gavin, what were your sort of thoughts when you heard about this, this call from the Bishops Committee on Migration?
It seems like a pretty fair call to me. It's interesting watching the parallels between the immigration debate in Australia, probably more so than New Zealand because of the number of people who seek to come to Australia, and those in the US. Obviously, there isn't a land border for people to cross over in Australia, but they seek other ways to arrive on boats from Indonesia and elsewhere. And there is this very difficult tension between the dignity of people and the right of countries to secure their borders and to keep their own people safe. So it is a very vexed issue. I think there has to be a both and solution, but at the moment, often in the US and Australia and lots of other places around the world at the moment, there is this almost black and white discussion about an issue that I think has many shades of grey. And I think it's good that the bishops have weighed in on this issue, as they have in other parts of the world on this, and reminded people that we can often say, okay, well, you know, this many people are entering illegally or whatever it might be, but each of those is a person that we need to think about. But there are also ways that people can legally enter other countries through asylum and through other immigration methods. And it's important that people are responded to and supported in the appropriate ways. So I'm glad the church is a strong voice on this. Obviously, the Latino church is so prominent in the US when it comes to issues that are so heavily related to the Hispanic population, both within and outside the US. It's important that they have a strong voice in the debate.
That's a good point. I think this, looking beyond the statistics and seeing each person as being someone that has dignity. Anna, what did you make of the bishops? I mean, particularly this advocating for immigration reform, so really weighing in on politics, saying that they need to, you know, they want the politicians to look beyond rhetoric, which is kind of like asking them to, you know, not breathe. I mean, I can't see any of them working beyond rhetoric. But what did you make of the bishops weighing in on this topic?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I was thinking the other day that perhaps the mistake that the Democrats have made and continue to make is I mean, we can all agree that Trump is not the, you know, he's a difficulty, the way he works. And but I think it seems that Democrats haven't wisely engaged with him. And so I'm glad that this response from the bishops is not just about Donald Trump sort yourself out, but that there is an element that the Democrats are, you know, they're in this as well, and their actions are also part of this kind of mess, I suppose. And that, you know, there needs to be, someone has to, you know, wise up and engage in a way that makes or resolves these problems, because there are people suffering, not just those at the border, but those who are not getting paid for, you know, don't have work at the moment because of the government shutdown. So, you know, this is something that needs to be done quickly, and this kind of backwards and forwards and isn't getting going anywhere. So, you know, there's some wise heads need to sort some things out, I think, and certainly calling for them to, you know, perhaps there's a sense of there's a bit of childishness going on, and to, you know, yeah, to do something about it and be positive and proactive in what they're doing.
Don, what do you make of this? I mean, particularly this point around, you know, looking to the individual, which is, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit easier said than done when you're talking about thousands of people wanting to cross the border. But I guess this call towards, you know, more mature, developed dialogue rather than sort of rhetoric on either side. I mean, you know, the shutdown hasn't ended. It's still going, you know, still neither the twain shall meet. What do you sort of make of all of this?
I don't know. I saw Trump's address to the union, and he put some good stats out there. Basically, like, on the journey to the US, there's 30% of women that get abused or raped on the way. There's been several children that have basically died at the end of the journey. The immigration services or the border control services aren't coping. There's 1,000 detentions every day, so of people crossing that border. So there's definitely an issue. And I guess America has a right to secure their border. There are drugs, might not be the main way that drugs are getting through, but there's certainly plenty of drugs that are coming through the border through people crossing the border illegally. And there's a massive drug problem in the US. Basically, I think it's up to 10% of US citizens are affected by drugs. So if that's not an epidemic, I don't know what is. So if you look at those stats and you look at, you know, there's 11 million illegal people in the US at the moment, that those are all pretty significant numbers. And I guess a wall would be part of that solution. And yeah, if you can dissuade people to try to make that journey, I think that in its own way is quite humanitarian, because it's an arduous journey. And there are people suffering as a result of trying to make those, that journey. And I'm sure there's what they call coyotes, these basically people with very little scruples who are helping people cross that border and making a living out of it and promising them lots and perhaps bringing them to slavery. And that's as a result of a border that's quite open. So if they build the wall and make it more difficult, I think that's a humanitarian thing to do.
Mm. I mean, it's an interesting way of thinking about it. I mean, I think, Gavin, there's something to be said for, I mean, obviously the US border has, you know, there's legitimate ways people can seek asylum and you know, if they are being persecuted, they can apply for asylum. Gone are the days of, you know, give the tired, huddled masses yearning to be free. You can do that. You just have to fill in the paperwork. So yeah. what do you take of sort of Don's take on Don? Don's take on the Donald, saying that actually this the view of allowing people in is not necessarily the right answer from a human point of view.
Yeah, again, to use the analogy with Australia, that, you know, there were changes in border policy back several years ago, and people started trying to come from Indonesia again, and I think the number is something like 1,200 people known to have drowned at sea trying to get to Australia, with the you know, often with the quote-unquote support of people smugglers who stayed back in Indonesia and took their money from people who they often sent away on boats that were not really seaworthy. So certainly there are various aspects of it. I mean, the you know, that big caravan of people that came out from Central America, there would have been all sorts, you know, any number of problems. Like, you know, the numbers Don cites there about the people being, the women being sexually assaulted, and that I read somewhere that the numbers are actually significantly higher than those that were being quoted.
Right, and Don was wrong. It was, Don quoted 30%, and they did a fact check, and it's probably closer to 60.
Yeah.
60% of women who are trying to get in are being abused.
Correct.
Yeah. So there are all sorts of, there's a huge amount of collateral damage from people seeking to come in this way. Now, one sort of theory that I put forward the other day was that if negotiation were possible between the president and Schumer and Pelosi, and even if they even want that, but I think to look at maybe increasing the number of legitimate refugees and asylum seekers that the US accepts each year, in exchange for an agreement to build the barrier, or whatever we're calling it these days, might be a policy concession that could be made from both sides to maybe try and bring about a solution. But I'm not sure that how much appetite there is for a solution at the moment. It's a, you know, it's a game of chicken that's costing people their lives down around the border, costing people their livelihood, those who are working in government that have been shut, you know, where they're not being paid as part of the shutdown. It's a very inhumane game of chicken that both sides of politics are playing. And I think my hope from a human perspective is that there's a resolution to this, and by the time that people are listening to this show, it's already been resolved. But there isn't much time for that. I mean, like I say, I don't see much appetite for it either.
No.
I have a solution. We can swap those Americans who think that socialism is a great idea and swap them with the people who are trying to come into the country, and then have a one-for-one swap there, and then they can see how great socialism is.
Well, welcome back, Don.
Venezuela.
Welcome back. I like it. It's good. I think the point around engaging meaningfully is a good one, and I think that hopefully, like you say, Gavin, hopefully by the time people are listening to this, it's already been resolved because people have engaged meaningfully. Speaking of engaging meaningfully, this is from Radio New Zealand. The Catholic Church has set up a new body to liaise with the Royal Commission's abuse inquiry, but its makeup has raised questions over its capacity to deliver truth. A leading world expert on clerical child sex abuse told Radio New Zealand that if Te Rōpū Tautoko remained top-heavy with church officials, it would only do the bidding of the bishops and would have no credibility. Dr. Peter Wilkinson, a former priest who acted as advisor to the Australian Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, made his comments after the group was formed last month to provide a coordinated response to the commission from all its dioceses, religious orders and institutions in New Zealand. The seven-person Te Rōpū Tautoko, that's really hard to say, Tautoko body was announced by the church hierarchy after the government extended the terms of reference of the Royal Commission's State Abuse Inquiry in November to include faith-based institutions. A similar group, the Truth, Justice and Healing Council, was established by Australian bishops to do the same job in 2012 when the government across the Tasman announced its own abuse inquiry, which released its findings in December 2017. That 12-person group was made up of three clergy and nine Catholic professionals, including a psychiatrist and a number of academics with expertise and understanding of trauma. It was chaired by former Supreme Court Judge, the Honourable Neville Owen. In contrast, Te Rōpū Tautoko is made up of six church officials, including heads of religious orders in which there have been accusations of a covering up abuse, and just one layperson, Chairwoman Catherine Fife, who specialises in human resource management. Dr. Wilkinson said the Catholic Church now risked losing any credibility it had left if it decided to respond to the Royal Commission in a less than genuine manner. One thing that the New Zealand hierarchy will have to understand, and quick, is that despite what they may think, they probably have already lost a great deal of their credibility, he said. If they try to duck and cover, use the bad apples defense, heap all the blame on their predecessors, insist that it is the media who are the cause of their troubles, or try to obfuscate, they will end up like the bishops here in Australia who have lost all trust from ordinary Catholics, from the general public, and from the politicians. Some pretty harsh words there, Anna, but I mean, you know, on the face of it, he's definitely got, well, first of all, he's got some credentials himself to be able to comment on this, Dr. Wilkinson. But looking at the makeup of the Te Rōpū Tautoko body, that does feel very church top heavy. What do you think?
Yeah, I was surprised when I sort of heard about the makeup of that group. I would have thought that, you know, a group like that is should be sort of relatively free from perhaps the input or I can't think of the word.
Influence.
Anyway. Yeah, influence. Thank you. Yeah, of the bishops and the religious institutes, but that they would mediate and coordinate between those groups and the Royal Commission. That's how I would see what they would do, so that they could, if they had a number of professionals who had experience in different areas of life, professional life and things like that, that they could make recommendations, and which is what pretty much happened with the Australian version of it. I mean, the thing is that from seeing what happened in Australia, some of the recommendations are ones that the church is never going to take on board, you know, breaking the seal of confession, perhaps getting rid of the celibacy in priesthood and things like that. So you know, because the church probably won't take those on board anyway, the church is going to seem to the public that they're not, you know, really responding genuinely, even though there'll be many things that they are doing that are further on perhaps in many other institutions. So we will lose a bit of respect, I think, from the commission anyway. But I think that this particular thing is an area where we could have perhaps done a bit better in choosing people that, yeah, might be able to give a bit more of a unbiased, it will be more like consulters as opposed to, you know,
Yeah, I think the point around objectivity is an important one. I mean, Don, you know, we talk about credibility, some credibility being lost. Let's be honest. The credibility is pretty much in tatters, I would have thought. And having the council sort of staffed pretty much entirely with heads of religious orders, does that feel a little bit the wrong way to go to you?
I'm kind of torn. I don't really mind who or what the council's made up of, as long as they approach the issue in a very direct and transparent and truthful way. And I guess when you make ideological recommendations like the celibacy one, where there is absolutely zero direct link between celibacy and the abuse of kids, that undermines the credibility of the report. And when I read that in the Australian Commission report, I thought that's the kind of stuff that makes it lose credibility. But no matter who's in it, as long as they approach it in a very open, transparent and truthful way, and a way that tries to get to the root cause of the issues, and I guess leaves no stone unturned, I don't really care who's in the commission.
Okay. So we've got both ends there. Gavin, where do you sort of fit on this? Do you think the commission is okay with who it staffs, so long as it's open in other ways and sort of compensates for it in that way? Or do you feel that the Te Rōpū Tautoku body, I'll get there eventually. Do you think that that's set up the wrong way? What's your sort of thoughts?
Well, certainly I think there was a sense that the way that the Truth, Justice and Healing Council operated in Australia was quite successful. And as the story suggested, that was made up mostly of lay people, but, you know, from a range of backgrounds with a range of different skills. Now I know three probably of the six members that are mentioned, so either the bishops or the leaders of congregations, or know them to one extent or another, all fine people. So I think there is a sense in which, to me, actually, probably what sits underneath this council is probably what's important. The infrastructure there to be able to engage with the Royal Commission meaningfully. The Truth, Justice and Healing Council in Australia compiled just thousands and thousands of pages of information to help the Royal Commission itself. The commission is appointed, so Anand Sachinand and the others around him, to be able to actually assess the church's history. So having those sorts of structures in place, you know, the back of house staff who can do that to ensure that the church is being as open as it possibly can be, because if there's not that in place, both the willingness and the operational ability to do that, the church's efforts to get to make sure that religions were included in the Royal Commission will seem a little bit hollow. So I think making sure that engagement is indeed genuine is the most important thing, and I trust that the people that have been chosen, the people who understand through their own context and no doubt in a broader church context, the issues that the church has faced and are willing to to own up to them and help the Royal Commission be as successful as possible in turning the tide for the entire country, rather than you know, the church as a subset of a country and a culture, in which terrible things happen to children that shouldn't have happened, and certainly not at the hands of people in the church.
Yeah, I mean, Anna, it's a good point, actually, just in what Gavin was saying there, reminded me, you know, the commission was only extended to include religion, the religious institutions, at the behest of the church, actually petitioning quite strongly to say, expand the scope to include us in this. Come on, don't just keep it as state. So there's got to be, you know, some credibility around inviting this in to begin with. Yeah. And I guess, does that give them a good basis to start from?
Sure. Well, I mean, I would think so. And I would think that the way in which they have petitioned the government to be included is something that, you know, where credit is due, basically, give it. But I think it really just gets swallowed up in all the sort of bad feeling that is around all the sexual abuse stuff, unfortunately. So again, you know, like all the good stuff that is happening is either it's not being, you know, put out there, or people are just, you know, it's too little too late, or, you know, something like that. So yeah, I think that, you know, probably whatever happens, the credibility of the church will probably, suffer through this, because all the, you know, hopefully the truth will come out, and so what, even all the good things that the church is doing and has done, probably seem like not enough compared to the scandal. I think, you know, it's still something that needs to be done, and it means that we can build upon that good stuff that's already happening and, you know, stop it from happening again. So it's worth going through it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just hopeful that, it's a good discussion. I'm just hopeful that we do engage meaningfully with this. So this is something where, as we've talked about before, there's no amount of openness or frankness that can be too much when it comes to trying to rebuild trust and paying for what's happened in the past. So here's hoping that's how this works. Don already referred to a tie to celibacy in that previous article, and then this is our next one from the Catholic News Service. German Cardinal Reinhard Marx of Munich and Freising called for a change in long-standing church tradition as the German Bishops' Conference prepares for a workshop debate to review the issue of celibacy for priests. In his homily at New Year's Mass at the Cathedral of Our Lady in Munich, Marx said that the Church must, in light of the failure surrounding the clergy sex abuse crisis, modify tradition in response to changing modern times. "I believe the hour has come to deeply commit ourselves to open the way of the Church to renewal and reform," Marx said, according to a text of the homily posted on the Archdiocesan website. "Evolution in society and historical demands have made tasks and urgent need for renewal clear to see," end quote. The cardinal, who is president of the German Bishops' Conference, said that the current measures to address sex abuse are not enough without adapting church teachings. "Yes, matters are about development and improvement and prevention and independent reviews, but more is also demanded," he said. "I am certain that the great renewal impulse of the Second Vatican Council is not being truly led forward and understood in its depth. We must further work on that," he said. "Further adaptations of church teachings are required." The cardinal's statements coincide with plans to openly debate the issue of celibacy at the German Bishops' Permanent Council meeting in the spring. The bishops have said that the workshop during the meeting is a direct response to the abuse crisis. Pressure to end mandatory priestly celibacy has risen in Germany following the renewal of the sex abuse scandal last year. "The history and purpose of priestly celibacy is now a hotly contested issue in Germany, as sexual freedom is a core principle of modern German culture." Well, Don, I mean, you sort of talked a little bit about it in the last one. Let's talk a little bit more about it now. It's a misconception, I think, that's pretty widely conceived. It's a misconception. that celibacy, there's a tie between celibacy and sexual abuse. I've heard a number of people say that, although it doesn't make sense, because to me anyway, because if that was the case, then you wouldn't have sexual abuse occurring in people who are not otherwise celibate. And of course, in the rest of society, unfortunately, more than unfortunately, we absolutely do. So what do you make of the German bishops Cardinal Marx saying this is something that needs to be reviewed because of the sex abuse scandal?
Well, it's got no relationship with the sex abuse scandal. So if you look at the statistics, basically the stepfathers are the most likely people who are in danger of, you know, abusing kids. So presumably they're not celibate. So that just makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Like, there's just no relationship between chastity and sexual abuse. And you just think about that on an individual level. Like, a person just not having sex suddenly is drawn towards kids. That makes no sense. Yeah. That's just dumb and daft. So let's kick that for touch.
The stat you're saying there about stepfathers being the most likely, where have you heard that stat before?
That's just, I was reading some crime stats, but I could be wrong in that.
But, no, that's cool. So we'll definitely have to check it out. But anyway, yeah, sorry, carry on.
But yeah, just on a theological level, priests are sacramental. Our tradition is that priests are sacramental ministers that act in persona Christi. So that's in the person of Christ. Jesus didn't get married, and the church believes in the chastity of Christ himself. So yeah, there's biblical quotes for Africa. Sacrifice of married life is for the sake of the kingdom, Luke 18:28-30, Matthew 19-22. And you know, just the following example of Jesus being married to the church, the bride of Christ. If you look at Matthew 19:12, some eunuchs were born that way, others were made that way by men, and others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. So there's plenty of scriptural references to priests not being married and being celibate. There's just no, this is just the modernist movement, which goes away from the tradition of the church and has no place in a church which is founded by Jesus Christ and seeks to uphold and continue that tradition.
Gavin, I mean, just putting aside for a moment that obviously Don's been off the podcast for a while and has forgotten it's a Catholic podcast, so he's been quoting scripture. just kidding, Don. Just kidding.
We put it together.
Yeah, that's true. That's
good made
point.
Up stuff.
That's a good point. We put it together and then we forgot how to quote it. No, it's a good point. But the issue, so, okay, I'm sort of the opinion that if this would be a black and white issue, if child sexual abuse was only occurring in celibate people, right? Then no one would be arguing the toss. It would be, you would have a direct link between celibacy and this terrible, terrible abuse. But that's just plainly not the case. So this, what do you make of the need to debate this? Because separately, the issue of priestly celibacy, as we've talked about previously on the podcast, it's not the same as something like female priests, for example. So women priests can never happen in terms of the church, as Pope John Paul II or Saint Pope John Paul II pointed out. Priestly celibacy, on the other hand, has been something that has not always been in the tradition of the church. So it can change in theory, anyway. So it's not a matter of whether or not it can; it's whether or not it should. And then, even if it should, why it should. So, what do you sort of make of what the Cardinal is pointing out here? That it's something that needs to be addressed now.
Yeah, I think that what they're looking to address is an important thing to address, clearly, the issue of abuse and why it happens and that sort of thing. I think that sometimes celibacy becomes the central focus when I think there needs to be, and I agree with the Cardinal where he talks about need for reform and renewal. I mean, the church, wasn't there some Semper Reformandi or something, like church is always reforming. It needs to continue to do that. But I think there needs to be discussion around human sexuality and sexual maturity. And I think that's, I think there's no doubt that there were men predominantly and a small, very small number of religious women probably, who weren't formed well to prepare them for a life of celibacy or chastity, depending on their state of life. And I think that's certainly a factor in what has led some priests to stray, you know, with children and with teenagers and even with adults. So I think that's an issue that really needs to be looked at quite closely. And a lot of work has been done in a lot of places where the abuse crisis has been known to exist for a longer period, like Australia and the US and Ireland. People have looked at the formation of priests and the formation for a life of celibacy and the need to do that. But I think there is, I mean, it's just, I mean, you've both already said how the folly of this connection, and so much as that, again, the horrors that priests would commit these crimes, and brothers and sisters, those who have taken vows of celibacy or chastity would do this, is just abhorrent. But the fact that it happens, even if you just look in the religious context, it happens in denominations that don't have celibacy, and denominations that have married priests where there are women ministers as well. It's a plague that exists across all of society, almost wherever people have access to children. We often find that there are people who use that to commit the greatest evil. So I think that the bishops looking at ways to address the sexual abuse scandal is obviously important. I think they're barking up a tree in the wrong forest, to sort of mix a couple of metaphors. Not just barking up the wrong tree, they're in the Black Forest. Is that in Germany?
I think that is. I think
they should
is.
Be in the White Forest. I don't know, but so yeah, that's a rambling.
That's right. You're good, Don. Sorry.
It's even worse. They're basically using the sexual abuse crisis and using it as excuse to push their modernist agenda. So it's even worse. It detracts from the real questions we should be asking about the sexual abuse crisis. And it's not right. And politicizing an issue to pursue a modernist agenda with no facts to back it up is clearly wrong.
I mean, Anna, do you think there's something based on this that is predicated on a fundamental misunderstanding about sex, in the sense that it seems that the modern societal viewpoint on things would hold that anyone who would be celibate by choice, that's a foreign concept. Like, it's just not possible. It seems in this over hypersexualized Western society in particular, we have the sense that nobody would choose to go there, you know, we'll choose to wait before marriage, let alone go their entire life without having that component of their life in play. And is it therefore assumed that anyone who does make that choice is obviously crazy and a deviant and therefore more likely to commit these terrible, terrible crimes? Or am I connecting too many dots?
Look, that might be part of it. It might be that life of celibacy, of freely chosen celibacy, that's, you know, lived out in a pure and holy way, it's a threat to I think the sexual freedom, or, and I, you know, use my fingers as inverted commas, whatever, you know, that our society wants, because we've told ourselves that, you know, having lots of sex and freely with anyone and whatever is liberating, and that's what, you know, we've you know, escaped the shackles of, you know, the dark ages and all that kind of stuff, and But in fact, what we've discovered is that it doesn't actually, you know, make our lives better. And in fact, it's heaped a whole horrible rape culture upon us, a sexual abuse culture, pornography culture, just a whole lot of horrible things. And people are really struggling to find good, authentic relationships with others, and good sexual relationships with others. So, you know, like, I wonder if, you know, yeah, it's like, it's a threat. So true celibacy, a freely chosen celibacy, freely lived celibacy is a threat, I think, to that particular way of living. Hmm. I find this whole debate about celibacy just... like, as you say, like, it's not a theological thing, but it's actually, and it's often called a discipline of priesthood, but actually I think it's something more profound than that, than just, oh, it's just something we do at the moment and it could be changed. But Christ's spousal relationship with the church is something that is incredibly fundamental, and so therefore the priest lives that. So in fact, he might be celibate, but he actually lives a spousal relationship. And that is something that priests can find very fruitful in their life. And when you kind of start going, you know, reducing celibacy to, yeah, it's the cause of sexual abuse, or, you know, we should be sexually free and all that kind of stuff, it's just not great. And it fails to really understand that beautiful relationship between Christ and the church, and therefore the priest and the church. So,
Yeah, and to quote scripture again, there is a scriptural passage about basically priests looking to keep their wives happy and being distracted. So, just on a practical level, that presumably the priest would be married rather than being very open and sexual. So they're married to their spouses, and their devotion should be to their, you know, keeping their wives happy. So they're distracted from their congregation. So on a very practical level, it's not a very good idea.
We've definitely talked about that on previous episodes of the podcast, that as other Christian denominations have pointed out when queried over the years, that it provides a real challenge around split loyalties for the priest in terms of family and church. But I just think there's something, there's a fundamental disconnect that people think celibacy and chastity are the same thing. And the reality is that sexual abuse is nothing to do with celibacy and everything to do with a lack of chastity. It is a crime. It's an evil, abhorrent act. And it is not a matter of, it's disordered. So to turn around and say that anyone who has freely chosen to remain celibate, that connects to a disordered disposition is, I think, taking it a little bit too far. Anyway, we'll move on. This is from the next one, talking about complicated sexual issues. This is from NZ Catholic. The National Centre for Religious Studies has released a document that provides Catholic schools with guidance on how to navigate issues pertaining to gender diversity among young people today. Gender complexity in schools, which is endorsed by the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Conference, acknowledged that gender dysphoria is real. According to the American Psychiatric Association website, gender dysphoria, quote, involves a conflict between a person's physical or assigned gender and the gender with which he, she, they identify. A statement released by the NZCBC explained that the document provides a point of reference for schools in the support and accompaniment of children and young people, quote, who may be experiencing gender dysphoria in our schools. National Centre for Religious Studies Director Colin McLeod said, the document is intended to provide appropriate and practical guidance regarding this complex issue in our schools. It does not cover every aspect, but acknowledges the need to treat every person with love and respect and to support students in their growing self-identity in a kind and sensitive manner. It was stressed in the document that no person's identity can be reduced to their gender or sexuality, nor should they be labelled by any other single aspect of their personhood, for example, their ethnicity. Quote, the truly holistic view of the human person is what the church teaches. To be understood as authentically human is to be whole and entire, body and soul, heart and conscience, mind and will. Gaudium et Spes, number 3, noted the document. Recognizing that we are all created in the image of God and are united in Christ, we can then marvel at the diversity which marks the worldwide human family. As stated in the document, genuine questions may emerge for a small percentage of young people in schools. Quote, genuine questions, when they arise, should be responded to in a non-judgmental way, showing care, compassion, and a willingness to listen. It's a tricky one, Gavin, a tricky, complex issue, I guess, that society as a whole is kind of grappling with this this issue of gender dysphoria. And what do you sort of make of this, of the guidelines being issued by the National Center for Religious Studies?
Yeah, I mean, it is an issue that... it is affecting all schools, certainly, and because the Catholic Church has a certain understanding about the human person, which we've already sort of spoken about in another context today, I think it's appropriate that an issue like this, gender dysphoria, is addressed from a Catholic perspective. There are so many, you think about it in the context of, for example, an all-boys school, where a child might be sort of 15 or 16 at an all-boys school and now says that he would like to identify as a girl. How a school manages that, and, from a pastoral perspective, from a theological perspective, from a practical perspective, we don't have girls' toilets at our school. We don't have a girl's uniform. There are so many aspects to it. Before you even start thinking about, what's the theological response that we have to this? What's the pastoral response we have to this? How does the church understand sexuality? And therefore, how does the church respond in a way that is genuinely the best response for that young person in the case of students? And there are many different approaches, some of which would not be well received by the community, some of which would be abandoning the church's understanding of the human person in terms of their dignity. So like the issue I think we started the show with, immigration, a very different issue, but one in which there are many more shades of grey, I think. But it is important that the church show that it is seeking to be proactive in this area, as schools no doubt are grappling with this quite often. So this is just one part of the sort of the gender identity, gender orientation, sexual orientation paradigm that is becoming more and more prominent in every school context, not least Catholic schools.
I mean, and it is a difficult topic, but at the same time, it's probably good that the NZCBC is getting on board with this and explaining the document, providing a point of reference for the schools and taking in that whole aspect. Because again, as we've just been, we haven't even been talking about this, but sexuality and gender is one component of what makes a person. It is not the sole in sum total. So it's good to kind of get that focus across the schools, isn't it?
Well, I guess so. I guess the thing is that, and Gavin touched on this, was my difficulty with this is that the church often responds in one way, and at the moment there is a real disconnect between the teachings of the church around this and, for instance, in New Zealand, like the government and the doctors and how they would approach it, and parents, how they would approach it. Like, there's a real disconnect there. And it's not an easy topic to talk about, and it's not easy for anyone who is sort of experiencing that, those difficulties. I don't know. I think there is a real difficulty in trying to maintain, our the truth about a human person and their biology, which is a very, although it might not be the only, it might be one of many aspects to a person, it's still a truthful, it's still a truth about the person, right? And that, yeah, and the way in which our society usually approaches it is just as long as I think that, then, you know, like there's a sort of sense of what is thought, what is thought in the mind is the is what is true. And we, of course, would say otherwise. But it means that there isn't real genuine study or, you know, development of understanding of these kinds of this dysphoria, of gender dysphoria. So, you know, it's really hard because I think that there's, you know, a lot of things we don't know about it, and we're probably actually putting our young people through some pretty horrific stuff that might be, that should be, well, that are, I believe, unnecessary. But yeah, we're treating it in a bad way. But I guess it's a start to have something out there. But I think it's something that needs to be worked on. It's an ongoing process, I guess, of understanding and knowing what to do in certain circumstances.
It is complex indeed. I mean, Don, what do you make of this? Do you think that it's something that, that need the schools need? They need this kind of guidelines published to them in terms of making sure they're taking the whole aspect of the person and doing things from a holistic view?
I think so. I would have taken a different approach. I would have taken more of a kind of Jordan Peterson type of approach and gone hard, because we are fighting against a kind of Marxist ideology that seeks to take out the differences between men and women. And I think the Catholic Church, for one, needs to fight against that ideology and not conflate the two issues. Like, for one, it needs to fight against that ideology, but at the same time, we need to recognise the people with gender dysphoria and have absolute sympathy for them, but actually recognize that they need medical treatment just like a person who's not happy being a human being and thinks he's, say, a cat. Those are psychological issues and need to be treated as such. And I guess the church really needs to fight back against those kind of Marxist gender ideologues that would encourage people who have gender dysphoria to basically dwell in their kind of fantasy or their discomfort with their own assignment of you know, sex or how they were created, instead of getting the right medical treatment, which would entitle them to be more comfortable with what God gave them.
Okay, but so even if you take the position that, you know, gender dysphoria is a condition, obviously, that needs treatment, shouldn't the schools still be, if a person is suffering from that condition, that they still need to be able to be, you know, schooled, they still need to be accepted, they still need to be able to go to school, don't they?
Yep, but shouldn't they have the treatment to overcome their issue?
The school's not going to be the one providing that treatment, though. The school needs to be guided on, like, you know, I'm trying to draw an analogue with any other condition that is being treated, that you would still want the school to be able, the child to be, you know, schooled without having that, that, you know, with that taken into consideration.
Okay, you take the cat. So there's an individual who thinks that they are a cat. So should the school walk around basically indulging that fantasy and putting out milk for them?
But if there's a difference between
But what the Marxists would do, or the ideological Marxists would say, well, these guys need like a separate bathroom, or they need to use a bathroom that's consistent with their gender preferences. So using that same analogy, I think they should just be treated in all accordance to their biology.
Okay. All right. Well, it's I guess it's these kind of these issues that do require the church and society and the church as part of society to constantly examine, re-examine, and then see what sense we can make of these things, I guess. A final story is from the Associated Press. Father Jim Sitchko has a 50-state congregation and a simple mandate from the Pope: go forth and do good deeds. That's why the Roman Catholic priest found himself standing by the drive-through of a popular Hollywood fast food joint on a recent windy, rain-swept afternoon, buying lunch for everyone who stopped by. The next day, he'd be at a gas station in Kentucky, topping off people's tanks. Sitchko is a papal missionary of mercy, a rarefied group of 700 from around the world, including several from the United States, who were appointed directly by Pope Francis in celebration of a Jubilee of Mercy that began in December 2015 and has since been extended indefinitely. Missionaries were assigned to travel the world, spreading kindness, forgiveness, joy, and mercy to everyone they encountered. Some responded by using their newly granted authority from the Pope to perform confession and forgiveness of sins basically anywhere at any time. Others took to radio airwaves or retreats to offer messages of joy. Sitchko, a Kentucky-based preacher, came up with an idea different from the others and got his bishop at the Diocese of Lexington to sign it off. He'd travel his country performing random acts of kindness in all 50 states. He's provided groceries for half a year to a man with HIV and paid for medical services for a struggling Muslim family. This Christmas, he's headed to an elementary school in Corbin, Kentucky, where more than a quarter of the population lives in poverty. There he'll surprise the school's 100 second graders with shiny new bicycles. First question people ask is, why are you doing this? Sitchko says between bites of his double-double cheeseburger in the crowded In-N-Out restaurant down the street from the Hollywood Walk of Fame, where he just bought lunch for everybody. My question, the balding, bespectacled 51-year-old cleric adds with a smile, is why not? Is why not? Why not go and buy everyone lunch? Hey, Anna, what do you think? Hey, this is these papal missionary of mercy, missionaries of mercy, and this is how he is deploying his. What do you make of it?
Oh, well, I don't want to be the one who goes, who poos someone's acts of kindness.
Here she comes.
Oh, no.
But.
No, look. Doing those one-off things is great, and I like it. It really brings joy to people when, people do random acts of kindness to others, and I think that's a really good thing to do, and I would really encourage that. I'm wondering if that's really the mandate that this particular priest has been given.
Right.
That would just be, so I'm not saying, he shouldn't, buying food for people or groceries or, but I think he's a missionary of mercy, and, perhaps there's...
Sounds like a missionary of munchies.
Well, but I mean, he did do things like, the medical services and all that kind of stuff, which is, those things are a big deal, especially in the States, because they're so expensive and... I think, those little one-off things are nice, and maybe it reminds you that, there are good people in the world and all that kind of stuff. And so that's always a good thing to be reminded of. And I just sort of feel like maybe he could actually be doing something even more profound than that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Don, when I sort of first read this, I thought to myself, oh, really, is this what he's choosing to do, pay for people's In-N-Out burgers? But then, if he wasn't doing something like that, would it be getting covered by the Associated Press? I mean, maybe this is, trying to that pay it forward idea and getting people to kind of think differently. He had to do something a bit more splashy. I don't know. What do you think?
I want to know why he went to In-N-Out, because that's pretty high end, so he should have gone to something maybe a little bit lower demographic, so he could maybe reach people who needed it more, because In-N-Out people generally, I don't see them as really, really needing the free meal, whereas someone who maybe at the local KFC that becomes a more targeted approach to what he's trying to achieve.
Okay, all right. What do you think about that, Gavin? You've been to the States. He's going through all 50 states, doing something different in each state, it looks like. But I guess Don's point is maybe he should be choosing places where he can have bigger impact. And Anna's point is that he can choose to do some things that maybe are a little bit more meaningful. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I do wonder if your point is one of your many astute observations, James, that he might do some other wonderful things that just aren't quite as interesting to the fine folks at the Associated Press. So, they do mention that others were doing things like hearing confessions and that sort of thing. So he may well be doing other things. I think that I suspect there are some wealthy benefactors in Kentucky who are helping the Diocese of Lexington to spread some joy. I just wonder if there's enough joy to be spread just within Kentucky, which is probably not a state that I would say is necessarily flush with cash.
I thought you were going to say not a state that's very joyful, and I was going to say, I don't know. I don't know Kentucky that well.
Fried chicken. That's right. But I think it's interesting that his mandate is to travel around the country and do that. A priest portrayed in a good light in a secular newspaper, we'll take it.
Yeah, we'll take it. And I didn't even really know what a papal missionary of mercy was until the Associated Press picked up this story. So there you go, Father Jim. I know more about what you guys do now. So there's something to be said, I guess.
He could have saved himself some money as well, because apparently 60% of guys go to McDonald's just to purchase fries or a drink. So he could have saved himself heaps if he just went to Macca's.
Well, there you go. If you want to save yourself heaps, you can go back and listen to our previous episodes of The 15th Station, all of which are free. So there you go. You could save yourself the money that you would have paid for such high-quality content by going to www.station15.co.nz and listen to them. See if you can find the last podcast that we had the Don on, and we welcome him back, as I said before. If you'd like to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at podcast@station15.co.nz or feedback@station15.co.nz. I was listening to some old episodes and realized that I interchanged the email address. So I've got them both set up, podcast or feedback@station15.co.nz. or twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. And if you're looking for us on your podcatcher of choice, you can find us in the iTunes. If you look in iTunes for The 15th Station, you can also find us in Google Play, looking for The 15th Station. You can also find us on Spotify. So we're now available on Spotify in the podcast section there. So if you've got a smart speaker or something, you can just ask it to... listen to us. I was just going to try and trigger a few words there, but a certain marketing company in Mountain View, play The 15th Station and then see what happens. Thanks very much, Gavin. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for making the time, mate.
Thanks, James. Nice to talk to you.
Pleasure talking to you, and to you as well, Anna. Thank you so much for making time in your summer to get on board with The 15th Station.
No worries.
And Don, it's fantastic to welcome you back, mate. Let's not make it so long again till your next episode. Thanks for making your time, mate. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, everyone out there, for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We hope that you'll listen to us again next month. And until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.